This podcast is brought to you by Workle, a platform helping people get happier at work. Find out more at workle.co. Work happier.
What do you want to do in the world? Do you want to impact climate change? Do you want to impact your local community? You know, are you really passionate about young people and poverty? Have I learned most of my lessons through life and doing and failing and winning? I feel like I was going to be sick. I literally was going to be sick. I couldn't hear because I was so nervous.
Welcome to the Happy Work Life podcast, where people with inspiring careers reflect on how happy they have been in their working lives. On this podcast, we hear from a range of people working in business, startups, science, academia, media, healthcare, fashion, and much more, and find out which roles gave them the most satisfaction and, importantly, what they have done to get happier at work. So, sit down with me, Mark Price, founder of Workle, to help you get happier at work. Workle is the platform where you can find a job in the happiest companies, take our happiness test, network, and get career support from experts, and much, much more. Welcome to this edition of the Happy Work Life podcast, and I'm delighted to be joined by Elliot Ray. Elliot's a speaker and an author, and he specialises in helping organisations support working fathers, improve men's mental health, and engage men in conversations around gender equality. You might well know Elliot because he founded the parenting platform Music Football Fatherhood, better known as MFF, which was called the Mum's Net for Dads by the BBC. He writes for newspapers, he's been a broadcaster, and has had one of the most successful documentaries on the BBC in 2022, simply called Dad. So, Elliot, it's great to be able to talk to you, and you've achieved so much. And where I'd like to start is your early years. So was there anything in your early years at school or out of school that led you on the journey that you've been on?
That's a big question, Mark. It's a big question. It's a hard one. I think I've always been very motivated. I've always wanted to do stuff outside of the norm, if you like. So even at school, I played music. I was a DJing and made music in terms of production and bass playing. So I was probably more fixated on that than my schoolwork. Very interested in football. So again, more fixated on that than my actual schoolwork. So
I've always been kind of, Elliot? Who do you support?
I support Queen's Park Rangers, unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
I know. We're not looking good at the moment. That's a whole other podcast. So I've always wanted to do something interesting with my life, I guess. And that changed throughout time in regards to as I grew and went through different experiences. But I've always kind of worked very hard, been creative. And it's interesting because my sister, Nicola, also does kind of creative coaching. And we talk quite a lot about what is it that both kind of supported or enabled us to do what we do now, because my parents are the complete opposite. You know, they're very traditional, Caribbean immigrants, very hardworking, the kind of job for life sort of thing. So we are the complete opposite in regards to career choices. And they would hate to do what I do. It would be their worst nightmare. In terms of getting up in front of people and, you know, all that job insecurity that comes with being self-employed and whatnot. But I think what they gave us was stability and love and always being there as a kind of fallback option, which I think enabled us to then go and seek fulfillment and belonging and be able to express ourselves through our careers. I think that's how it happened.
And at school, what did you enjoy? Were there any particular lessons or subjects that sort of ticked all the boxes for you?
So you probably wouldn't be surprised. PE and music were the two things that I really liked. You know, I loved PE. When I was in school and kind of college, very, very active, used to run for my school, competed at county level in terms of, you know, long distance, loved football and always been into music. So those are the two subjects that I really liked. I liked maths as well. You know, maths wasn't bad and history was okay too. Didn't enjoy science and English too much, but I look back at my school years and think it was okay for me. You know, I know some people find school very difficult, I wasn't in any way remarkable at school. I think I was probably, to be honest, quite forgettable to my teachers. I don't think, they know who I am now, but I don't think I didn't stand out in the class in any way. And that was okay with me. I think I was finding myself, had a lot of friends, kind of got on with everybody, but I wouldn't say I was the smartest in the class or the naughtiest or the loudest. I kind of just existed. It wasn't until I left school that I think I found myself a little bit more and became more confident. And that happened at university and, early 20s. I think I came into myself a lot more at that stage of my life.
So let's talk about that a bit more then. So, university, what did you study at university, and how do you feel that developed you?
So I went to Roehampton University and I loved it. So when I look back, I was probably, as I think a lot of people are, too young in a way. Like it's quite hard to pick a uni degree and commit for 3 years and spend a lot of money on tuition and accommodation when you're still growing. You don't really know what you want to do with your life, or most people don't at 17 when they're choosing. So I think I went to uni and I don't think I necessarily embraced the work element of it as much as I could have done. And I probably would appreciate going back now, to be honest. I studied business and marketing. So I did have an idea of what I wanted to do, but I can't say I really knew how I'm going to use that degree as a career afterwards. But what I think university gave me was a lot of exposure to the real world. I think university is a chance to kind of reinvent yourself from the person you are at school. It's very easy to become one person, and that's who you are for 6, 7 years at school. I think university was an opportunity to reinvent myself, to make lots of new friends, to really find out what I'm interested in and go further with that. So I was the on-campus DJ, loved music, loved socializing, loved partying, loved connecting people. Loved being involved in the different societies, like the African Caribbean Society. So I think university gave me that, gave me some great friends, my best friend from university, Jermaine. And I grew so much, leaving your parents' house, having to look after yourself, make your own decisions. I learned so much. And I think that set me up very, very well for the rest of my life. But I think also, I think I found myself. I found my confidence and my voice. And I was able to be the person that I think I was growing into, but maybe in my old environment didn't support. So I really, really look back fondly with my university years. Actually, I loved those 3 years. Some really, really good times.
And did you enjoy your course?
The course was okay, but as I said, I was a bit young, I think, when I think about it. I was too young at 18 to probably leave home and dedicate time to studying and also enjoying life as a student, as you do, and lots of free alcohol around, £1.50 for a double Red Bull and Coke and stuff like that. So to actually dedicate time and learn my course properly, when I look back, I don't think many of us were in that position to do that. And I think it's a fundamental maybe flaw with education is that we get kids ultimately to pick, how they want to spend the rest of their life at such an early age. And so I think apprenticeships are great. Apprenticeships are great. I think getting some work experience is great. I think experience in the world, doing and trying different things, and then working out, oh, actually, this is what I want to do. I'm going to then go and study, would be a great option. And it's definitely something that, I would support my daughter in doing. Of course, if she wants to go to university at 18, that's fine. But I would also encourage and support her to maybe experience a little bit of the world and find out who she is and what she wants to do before committing to that. But I use business and marketing principles in my work now, I guess. So I did enjoy my course. Can I say I learned loads academically that I use now, or have I learned most of my lessons through life and doing and failing and winning? I would definitely say the latter. But not to discourage anyone from studying. Go to school. Go to school.
And then what happened after you finished at university? Because you didn't start on the path you're on now. So tell us what you did next.
So after uni, I applied for loads of marketing jobs, and I don't think I understood at the time probably what I was up against in regards to kind of privilege and access. So I applied for loads of jobs, hundreds of jobs, literally got no responses. And when I think about it now, and I think, for example, with my daughter, I'll be able to give her certain opportunities for work experience, certain connections in industries that she wants to explore, know-how of how to apply for jobs and operate in the corporate environment. And when I look back for me, even though, my parents did an amazing job, what they weren't necessarily able to offer was access into corporate organizations. So connections, sponsorship, work experience, know-how of how to operate in that world. And I think when we look thinking about social mobility, that is massive. I've got a friend actually who does similar work to me, an author, speaker, she's amazing. And I remember a couple of years ago, she put on LinkedIn that her son was looking for a job in graphic design. And one of her clients was Disney. And someone from Disney came back and said, oh, we can give them work experience. And we talk about that quite a lot now to say, these are opportunities that we can give our children or the young people around us that maybe we didn't have when we were younger because our parents they just weren't in that world, No fault of their own, just their circumstance. They weren't in that world. Whereas now having the opportunity to be able to have connections and the know-how, that the whole world opens up. So I applied for loads of marketing jobs. Nothing came back. And then my mom said to me, why don't you come and work in NatWest? Because she was a cashier. So applied for the job in NatWest. So my mom could help me with that. So I got into the bank. And I didn't know when she said, come and work with me, I'd be sitting next to my mother
Oh no.
in the bank,
How was
which
that?
was awkward.
Oh
I was on my best behavior. Yes, sir. How can I help you? Yes, madam. It was super awkward for 2 weeks. I was literally sitting next to my mom. So that was my first job, full-time job. I mean, before that, I was working since I was 14, paper rounds. I used to deliver the local paper on a Friday. There'd be stacks of these papers that would come to my house, hundreds of them to deliver. I had a job in Iceland when I was 17. I worked in JD Sports, retail. So I did a lot of retail jobs and I had lots of work experience from when I was about 14 years old. My dad was very, very strict on, hard work and education. So I'm a grinder, I'm a grafter, I know how to work. So joined NatWest. After 2 weeks, they moved me to another branch. And I worked in NatWest for 3 years, started in the branch, and then I went into the business center in Harrow, looking after business clients. I learned a lot from that experience and I worked really, really hard, So when I go into customer facing roles now, my respect is super high because the pay isn't great and the demands are high. They have to sell and they have the general public to deal with. And the general public can be quite awkward. So I learned a lot about customer service, hard work, selling, time management. And I think those experiences are amazing and they facilitate what I do now. So yeah, did that for 3 years. And then going back to my love of music and facilitation, I started a social enterprise called Make It Happen Music. And we worked with young people teaching them music production. For 2 years, I worked with different housing associations, different community organizations in schools, had like a mobile studio, and I loved it. It was incredible working with young people. The music was just the gateway to the conversation, but the real work was talking to them about gang violence, drugs, relationships, consent, alcohol, just anything that we're going through. Some of the kids were from quite difficult areas in Northwest London. So being able to connect with them and talk to them and build those relationships, some that I still talk to now, they're old men now with kids and stuff like that. But yeah, so it was an incredible experience. Unfortunately, a lot of the funding for that work got cut when the coalition government came in 2010. They pretty much cut a lot of the funding for a lot of the youth work and stuff like that. So the funding for my projects went, and so I had to go and do something else. And that something else was joining a temping agency. I worked in the Marks and Spencer's factory, and that was really interesting, actually. So that was the M&S building where they had all of the sofas and all of the homeware, all the furniture. And they would do all the design for their stores. So we would have someone come in from you know, ahead from a store design and say, okay, we want to get the red sofa here and the blue cabinet here and the TV stand there. And me and another guy would have to search this factory and find the red sofa. Get the red sofa, bring it over, and then say, actually, can you get the blue sofa? So we've got to go find the blue sofa, bring it over. And the blue sofa could be underneath a bed and underneath another bed and underneath another cabinet of drawers. And go and find that blue sofa, bring it over. And it was a really fun job, but really hard work. So did that. And eventually the temp agency recommended I go for an interview in the civil service. And so I went for an interview at DWP in Embankment. And that's how my kind of 12-year civil service career started.
But before we talk about that, can we just go back to the social enterprise you set up? Because you kind of easily, you said, oh, I was at the bank and then I set up a social enterprise. I mean, that's not an easy or straightforward thing to do. Most people listening to this podcast are going to be saying, well, how on earth did that happen? Why did it happen? What made you think about doing it? Why would you leave the security of a banking job to do it? Were you worried about money? So what was going on at that time? Why did you do it? And how did you think about money and supporting yourself?
I love this, Mark. No one's ever asked me this before. So going back to my, you know, the parents, they offered a lot of stability. I was at home at the time. I was 23 and a half, 20, coming on 24. And for me, I knew that what I was doing, and it was a good job, don't get me wrong, decent pay, working in the business center in NatWest. Even though it was a decent job for a lot of people, for me, it didn't speak to my purpose. I knew I'm an explorer. I'm a risk taker. I think there is so much to get from life. I want to try everything. And I knew I loved and love music and can play music and produce music, but I also love and always have loved like facilitation and conversation and connecting people. And so I had that idea that, you know, I have the university background. I can be someone these children can look to and be like, you know, I came from a similar place, but I'm a little bit older. I went to university, I worked in corporate, but at the same time, I'm into the same music and have a lot of the same cultural references. And there was so much opportunity at the time, you know, 2008, there was so much opportunity to create interventions that would help. So I actually got a loan from the bank, from NatWest, from the business center. I got a loan, a £5,000 loan from one of the colleagues that I was working with. He sorted it out for me. And that was massive, actually. And my parents did support me in that because, you know, I was at home. A lot of parents would say, no, you should be saving to get out of the house. But they supported me in taking a loan. And they can see that I worked very hard, very months of planning, lesson plans, marketing, designing logos. Back then, it was before social media, so you had to go to the trade fairs. They would have school kind of trade fairs where you'd go and set up a desk, and different safeguarding officers and pastoral leads would walk around and see what's available. So, you know, I spent loads of time going to those with my posters and my leaflets and talking about what I do, ringing up housing associations and saying, this is what I do. It was very much like the old school business where you have to go and talk to people, you know, and ring people and cold call. And it was that. And it was, you know, the grind before you could just DM someone on LinkedIn. And so that was a massive learning curve for me. And I learned a lot of lessons from that. You know, I definitely had a great time. I had some of my best moments in regards to helping people and connecting with people, whether it's they teach them how to make a drum pattern on the computer software and had these little keyboards that we'd program the drums in. Whether it was that, we filmed music videos around their songs. We did some big presentations where parents would come along and look at what they've been doing. Amazing, you know, amazing connections and conversations about their careers and their future aspirations. Incredible. At the same time, I did learn a lot about the business side of it. You know, I definitely undercharged myself. I was, not working for much. I probably overpromised in some areas as well. And I could have done a little bit more planning in terms of what my programs look like and forecasting. So I learned a lot, but you know that I had an amazing time and it was incredible.
And
And
did you discover, Elliot, that you'd like working for yourself?
yeah, I did.
And
I did.
what appealed to you about that?
I think the so it's not for everyone. You know, I think you have to be a certain type of person. You have to first of all have a big belief in yourself. You can't be too much of a worrier because your future income is not necessarily guaranteed. You know, you can't say I'm going to earn this much money next year. Your job isn't necessarily based on, well, interestingly, performance. It isn't, it isn't. You know, I think at work, you know, you go to work, you do a good job, you're probably going to get a bonus, hopefully. You may get promoted. There's a pathway for you if you're in a, you know, that kind of career. Whereas when you're self-employed or a business owner, that's not necessarily the case. You can be really good at what you do, but if no one knows about what you do, and if there's not a demand in the market for what you do, then you won't make any money. So you have to be the sort of person that's comfortable with that. You have to be creative, which I think I am. Have new ideas, put yourself out there, be willing to be rejected. And that's what I think life is all about for me, you know. So I definitely did, you know, experience that. But even before, when I was at uni, I was putting on parties and stuff like that. So that entrepreneurial spirit has kind of always been there. I've always wanted to do something in the world around that.
Okay, so we've now got a kind of a feel for you. And you're in the civil service, you've left what you were doing and you loved and you set up, funding dried up. You've now gone to DWP, Department for Work and Pensions. You're a civil servant. So how do you get from that, Elliot, to setting up MFF and doing all the things that you're now doing? What's the story?
So civil service. I have lots of friends in the civil service. Big organization. And when I first started, you know, it was a lot different to it than it is now. I think there was a lot more freedom. It was a lot more relaxed. You know, you could have a laugh at work, and there was budget for team away days and stuff like that. And I think everyone was a little bit more relaxed. I think by the time I left the civil service 12 years later, it did feel very, very different. Obviously, we're in a different place politically and economically in the country. And I think the civil service is definitely a reflection of how the world has changed and the UK has changed in the last 12 years. But yeah, when I first started, I started in DWP as a temp. I was a PA to a finance director, and she was a self-confessed workaholic, and her PAs didn't last very long. I think normally they last for about 6, 7 weeks, but I
Wow.
last for 6 months until I was going to leave. And I actually did leave. And then someone else I was working with called me back on the weekend, bank holiday weekend in August, I remember it, and said, you know, why don't you come and work in this other team? So I came back and worked with the other team. And the manager I worked with for there, Julia Sweeney, I ended up staying with her for about 5 or 6 years. I was her PA. She's really cool. She loves music too. She trusted me. We had a great relationship. And she ended up coming to my wedding. And at the same time, I was in a band with my wife. So we were gigging a lot around the country, we were recording. And so I was able to balance my work with being in the band as well. So I worked compressed hours. I didn't work on a Wednesday. And it really facilitated my life at the time, which was exactly kind of what I needed. And then in 2013, I got married and I thought, you know what, I better earn some more money. So I got a promotion and moved to the Department for Transport. And again, I've been lucky. I worked with another great manager, a guy called Jonathan Moore. He was a director general in the resources and strategy group for Department for Transport. And I learned so much about leadership from him. So much. You know, he was very consistent every day in regards to how he treated people, how he managed his emotions, and how he used his positional power in a really positive way. He used to do small things, like he would have a monthly meet the new joiners session. So everyone knew in his group, and his group was about 600 people. Everyone knew, and anyone else that wants to come could come along, and he'd bring donuts and coffee, and he'd talk about his life and KPIs and objectives and all the stuff that's going on work-wise. He'd talk about his life. He was going through a divorce at the time and whatever. So he'd talk about that. And then for 50 minutes, we'd say, like, you know, open the floor, ask me anything. And we'd have this conversation, and people would ask him random questions about the building access or his divorce or, you know, his career. And it was just incredible to see someone who was in such a senior position. Yeah, he was a deputy permanent secretary in that position, kind of being so vulnerable and open. You know, and I'd notice when people would walk past our area, they would stop and talk to him. And that wasn't the case for the other DGs and other people who were that senior in the organization. But he was so open with me, you know, over 3.5 years. I would say we had one little tiff, which I think is good for 3.5 years, you know? And that wasn't even a big thing. That was, he gave me some feedback. I didn't like it and I got in the mood, but he was right, actually. So over 3.5 years, you know, and that was due to just his consistency. I knew what I was going to get from him. No matter what was going on at home, no matter what stress he was under, he was very, very busy. He would come to work, he'd be polite, you know, he would understand the power of his words. And so that was a massive learning curve for me in regards to how he empowered others as well. You know, he would always think about what is the best thing to do for the outcome, regardless of what grade you're at or what level of seniority. It was more, who's the best person for the job? I don't want the most senior person coming to the meeting with me. I want the person who has been doing the work to talk. He was amazing. You know, Jonathan Moore, I always shout him out. I learned so much from him. He kind of empowered me to do work that was well above my pay grade. So, if you know, I was an HEO when I came to him, which is higher executive officer. It's just above the most junior grade. But he had me doing work which was at kind of a senior management level. You know, my first meeting that I chaired with him, working for him after 3 weeks, was with directors, and it was facilitating and coordinating a cabinet office review about our commercial capability. Way above my pay grade. I remember going into that meeting, I felt like I was going to be sick. I literally was going to be sick. I couldn't hear because I was so nervous. And I'd written down every single thing I was going to say in my introduction. I literally sat there reading my introduction. But in doing that review and working with stakeholders who were directors, getting paid six figures, and having teams of, you know, hundreds of people themselves, it kind of made me realize, oh, I can do this, actually. They haven't got two heads, most of them. You know, they're normal people. I can do this too. And I just need to believe I can do it, have confidence in myself. Yes, the experience helps. I've been doing these sort of things before, of course. You can spot trends and patterns, and you know what the problems are before they're going to come up. But yeah, after 3.5 years working for him, that gave me a lot of confidence to then go and apply for that more senior role. So I went on to become the head of race equality at DEFRA, which was my first role really being in senior leadership and people looking at me for answers and having to talk to the whole department, having to set the agenda, the vision. We did a project called Project Race. It was, I would say, the biggest people project in the department. It inspired other departments to set up the same. My countersigning manager was the permanent secretary, Claire Moriarty. She was amazing. She's now the CEO of the Citizens Advice Bureau. And that was real leadership. You know, that was kind of, Elliot, what are we doing? Having to set the agenda, having to chair lots of senior meetings, having to navigate stakeholders from all different levels. And I learned so much, you know, in that job. I really did learn a lot about leadership, you know, and the pressures that come with leadership and the difficulties that come with it and the responsibility, but also the things that you can achieve, you know, if you empower your team, if you have a clear vision, if you are, you know, if you work hard towards where you're going, if you can adapt, if you can listen, if you can hold space for people, if you can strategize, you can achieve amazing things. And we did. And I loved that job. It was really, really good. And then I went from there to be the head of D&I delivery at the Treasury. So again, another step up into, well, I was in senior management already, but further into senior management. And that was another challenge, you know, in the Treasury, which is a very, very traditional department that has lots of Oxford and Cambridge graduates, that is very middle upper class, very white. So to go into that kind of environment and make relationships, build relationships, again, vision, strategy, leadership, it was a massive, you know, learning curve for me. So my career in the civil service was something that I look back on fondly in terms of it set me up for what I do now. And I think I learned so much about organizational structure and leadership and change management and how things get done, essentially. And that is really, really good learning. And so while I was in the civil service, I was actually in the part for transport. In 2015, October, I became a father. And it was funny, actually, because I was doing kind of like people work before that. And I'd actually set up a parents group before I was a parent, because my manager, Jonathan Moore, was a champion of aging carers. So he said to me, Elliot, you know, I was basically responsible for doing all the stuff outside of HS2 and Crossrail, all these people stuff. I was responsible for kind of, not necessarily delivering, but coordinating and making sure it happened. So he said, Elliot, we need to do something around this aging carers champion role that I have. What do you think? So I was like, okay, do you know what? I'm going to set up a parents network. And then another lady in the office, she set up a young people's network. And we had a carers network already. So set up the parents network. I remember having a meeting with like John Lewis at the time, because they were setting up a parents network as well. And yeah, started this internal staff network and started to do some really interesting things, like build case studies of flexible working and share stories about different parenting experiences and create a page where we could put all our parenting policies in one place so they're easy to find and stuff like that. And then in October, when my daughter was born, you know, for us, it was obviously, you know, an amazing thing, but also definitely the most difficult time of our lives as well. She was born with an infection called Group B strep. So if people know about Group B strep, GBS, you know, 1 in 10 babies will sadly pass away from the infection. And around 1 in 14 will have a very serious lifelong disability after contracting meningitis from the infection. So when our daughter was born, she was very grey, you know, very lifeless, wasn't breathing. She had to be resuscitated. The doctors took her from my wife because she didn't cry. They put her on a side table. They used a straw to suck fluid out of her airwaves and resuscitated her. And at the same time, my wife was bleeding out very heavily on the other side of the room. So for me, it was definitely the first time in my life, my adult life, of, you know, being completely helpless and hopeless, and ultimately relying on these people that I'd met a few hours ago to save my family's life. So we were fast-tracked into NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, and spent a couple of weeks in the hospital. It was sent Princess Alexandra Hospital in Harlow. That first night was tough because I had to go home and leave my family, my daughter in the incubator, and my wife in the room. But after that, they gave us a private room in the hospital, actually. So I got to stay with them. And that was a real kind of crash course in parenting, because we were together in one room in the hospital. And every 3 hours, the doctors and nurses would kind of bang on the door and take someone to intensive care or, you know, for treatment somewhere and antibiotics and stuff like that. And so it was a real, you know, real difficult time, ups and downs over those 2 weeks. Sometimes we get good news and sometimes we get bad news. And it was really, really, really tough. But I would say that we held it together. I think the doctors were confident that they knew what was going on. GBS is quite common. It's unbelievable that we don't test for it here. We were lucky. We had a random test for something else in pregnancy. So my wife did receive antibiotics during childbirth, but my daughter still contracted the infection. I would probably say she wouldn't be here right now if we hadn't had that test, and my wife didn't have antibiotics, so we were lucky in that sense. But GBS is common, so they knew what to do with it, and even though it's very serious, they were confident that it would be okay. So ups and downs, but then after 10 days we got my daughter developed a bump on the back of her head about the size of a golf ball, like right here, and that's when it got very serious. You know, they called doctors and nurses in, they prepared us for different eventualities. We had to go for emergency MRI scans, blood tests, all that sort of stuff, lumbar punctures. And we had an MRI scan booked in the next day. And that night, you know, me and my wife and our baby in our room, we were joined by a midwife called Nagmeh. And we just cried and prayed all night. You know, we knew whatever the news is going to be tomorrow is going to change our lives one way or another. So the next day we did the MRI scan and waited through that burst through the door that the doctors and nurses did. They burst through the door, gave us a massive hug. You know, they said it's bone structure. You can go home. Amazing. So we went home on the Friday, had a weekend at home, had another day or two, and then by the Tuesday and Wednesday, I was back at work, you know, and having gone through easily the most traumatic experience of my life, I was in really, when I think about it, no state to go back to work, but my paternity leave had finished, you know, so I went back to work and I was ultimately pretending, you know, being in meetings, doing all the stuff, but was an insomniac, anxiety, panic attacks, randomly crying on the train on the way home. Just a shell of myself, really, and got diagnosed with PTSD eventually after a year. And I think that it's that made me think, do you know what? When I was going through the PTSD, and what I know about it now is that, and about myself as well, is that we, when things are so manic, yeah, being a new parent anyway, which is tough enough, and then the PTSD symptoms, having some control, I needed something to control, something that was mine that I could do that wasn't just changing with the wind. So that was, for me, was blogging. So I started blogging. And I called it Elliot Ray at the beginning.com or something. And then I changed it to Music Football Fatherhood because that's what I love. So I bought the domain name, started blogging about being a dad, and also started writing about music in relation to fatherhood. So, you know, if someone dropped a new song that was about being a dad or a parent, I might write an article about that. Or if a footballer spoke about their new child, or I might write about that. Or I wrote an article about how Wenger is a bit of a father figure to Arsenal players. And yeah, you know, I'd find ways of just relating music and football to fatherhood, and also just talking about being a dad. And over the months, you know, other dads saw that and said, oh, actually really cool, can I write for it? And they wrote for it. And then before we know it, we had five or six dads that were kind of contributing to this blog. This is in 2016, 17. And then I think what really kicked it off was one day I had the day off and I was in a coffee shop with my wife. And I started writing a piece about music, football, fatherhood, like what we were doing. And it just wasn't flowing. And then Sneni, my wife, was like, you know, you should write about what it's like being a dad, going to these baby groups and, you know, that sort of being a black dad and what it's like. So I thought, okay, cool. So I literally remember starting it. I don't remember writing it, but I remember it ending and then showing my wife, and she was like, this is great. And then I showed my sister. I emailed it to my sister and she was like, this is great. And my wife said, you should send this to the Independent. I was like, why would I do that? I don't know anything about the media. And she went on Twitter and she literally found the editor for Indie Voices. So you can submit articles to the Independent, you know, opinion pieces. So I thought, okay, cool. I emailed them in the coffee shop and they literally got back to me straight away and said, we want to publish this. Can you send a picture? So I sent a picture over and then we went home. By the time I got home, it was up on the Independent front page website and it was shared, I think, 17,000 times before I went to bed. And that was a real, you know, I believe in God. I do feel like that was a message. I don't remember writing the article, which is really, really weird. You know, I think I wrote it in about 5 minutes. I don't really consciously remember writing it. It just came out and it was shared 17,000 times before I went to sleep. And then from there, that's when Music Football Fatherhood became something. And then other dads started to get involved and people emailing saying, can I contribute? And a lot of the people from then, you know, still in the contributing team now. And then a few months later, the BBC came to my house and did a video with a few of us, a few of the dads and our kids. And they called us the Mumsnet for Dads. and yeah, so then it just kind of blew up even more and became a thing. And so we kept on going, kept on writing, we kept on getting deeper into what we were talking about. We did physical meetups, family meetups, we did online sessions. We published hundreds of articles on the blog. We started a podcast. We used to do Twitter debates about different parenting subjects on a Thursday. And it really kind of evolved. And we were just trying to figure out, you know, what works? How do we build the community? What do people want to talk about? And it was kind of, you know, always flowing, always moving thing. And then in 2019, you know, I had the idea to put Dad, our book, together, which there's a one here. So the idea behind Dad was we're having these conversations, but I know we can go deeper. We're maybe scratching the surface a little bit and we need to go deeper. And what's the best way to do that? For me, it was ask 20 men and dads to write their stories about fatherhood. And we have stories in there around, you know, widowhood, like Alec, who lost his wife during childbirth, his second child. Or we have Mark Williams, who suffered from very severe postnatal depression and now is an activist and campaigner around his issues. We have Ian Dowell, who went through a difficult breakup and couldn't see his kids on Christmas Day, tried to walk into Brighton Pier and nearly took his own life. Danny, whose son has very severe autism. Stories that are kind of raw and honest. And I asked those men to write down things they hadn't told anyone, and they did. And it's very moving, very, very moving. You know, I don't know anyone that hasn't cried reading some of those stories. It's fascinating. And I think what we wanted to do was really challenge ideas about masculinity in that. Interestingly, we went to publishers with the idea, and they all said, you know, it's a great idea. We love what we're doing. Oh, I'd love the book, but you know, because you're not famous and the dads aren't famous, then no one's going to buy the book. So my agent at the time was like, well, Elliot, you got to get famous then. I said, okay, what does that mean? Like, you know, do I go on Love Island? I'm over 30 and I'm married. So can't do that. What do you want? And that's not the point. The point is that these are teachers, civil servants, bus drivers. You know, this I say with love, normal people. And it's about time that we allow space for normal men, say normal men, to tell their stories. There's a market for that. So changed my agent. And then the year after, 2020, we went to publishers again. They said the same thing. So we said, you know what, we're going to do it ourselves. I was lucky enough to meet a lady called Stacey who knew how to get a self-published book produced, manufactured, and into Waterstones and Foyles and WH Smith. So I followed her advice. We raised a crowdfunder on International Men's Day 2021. We raised £12,000 in 10 days and we self-published the book. So the crowdfunder was in 2020. We self-published in 2021. And the book has done very, very well. You know, commercially, it's sold thousands. It's used by some NHS trusts to engage dads through the maternity process. It has influenced government policy, been part of APPG discussions, discussed in Parliament. And it ended up in the BBC staff room, where a producer called Zach picked it up on his lunch break and then read it and said, contacted me on Instagram and said, Elliot, we want you to present a documentary about your life and your work. And I was like, this is a joke. It's a prank. It wasn't a prank. And we ended up doing the documentary, which is Becoming Dad. You can watch on my website, elliotray.com. And that ended up being one of the most 20 watched documentaries across the BBC network in the whole of 2022, alongside some other upcoming names like Louis Theroux and Mick Jagger, you know, in good company. But yeah, I think what the book did and what the documentary did is just bring to the mainstream conversations that we're probably all having in our house, but maybe society didn't know it needed. So yeah, I'm super proud of that. And I think over my journey with the Independent article, there's been other crazy things that have happened. Like, you know, The Rock shared some of my work on Twitter, which was crazy, like mad. I won a UN award for my work in gender equality. And so these things kind of happened along the way in 2017 and 18 and 19, which were things that I think were signs to say you're doing the right thing. This is part of your life's purpose. And people sometimes ask me, like, is it difficult what you do or how do you... And I always go back to the point of I think we all have a purpose in life. And that can change as we grow up. But if you kind of lean into that purpose and you match that purpose with your natural skills and ability and find a way of matching your skills and ability, whether that is presentational skills, analytical skills, strategy, whatever it is, design, whatever your skills are, you can find a way to contribute towards what your purpose is, and your purpose in regards to, you know, what do you want to do in the world? Do you want to impact climate change? Do you want to impact your local community in regards to homelessness? Do you want to work on government campaigns around free school meals? You know, are you really passionate about young people in poverty? Whatever it is, working out and building strength, and, you know, whatever it is that you care about, how can you use your skills that you can, you know, they're natural, but you can develop as well, to contribute to something in the world? And I feel like throughout the last 7 or 8 years of being a dad and doing my work, I've definitely felt that. You know, I've worked hard, but it hasn't been hard, if I'm completely honest. Like, I've worked hard, don't get me wrong, been lots of sacrifice and sleepless nights, and my health has suffered. Not now, but in the early time when I was doing way too much, my health definitely suffered. So I worked hard, but at the same time, the universe, I think, was very open to receiving what I was doing. And so these things that are out of the, like, you know, I would never have thought The Rock would be like, Elliot, this is great. What you like on Twitter? It's ridiculous, right? Like, just stupid things that you think, I must be doing something right, because how the hell is that happening? You know? So yeah, it's been a mad journey. And, you know, three and a half years ago, I actually left my job. I left the Treasury to do this full time. It was getting to the point where I had to just make a decision, because I was essentially doing two full-time jobs and parenting, and it was too much. And I wasn't looking after myself very well and stuff like that. So I had to make a decision. Not only because of what I wanted to do in terms of my time, business, but actually just my own well-being as well. So after the last couple of years, I've been on a real kind of health journey, go to the gym a lot, try to eat well, try to get my sleep. Although last night I was still up at 12:30. But yeah, for me, it was definitely my well-being, because I've been working very hard for many years. I need to look after myself. But also I know that, you know, I believe this book was going to do well. I couldn't say that it was going to inspire a BBC documentary and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you never know. I think when you just lean into what you're doing and you work really hard at it and you're creative and you persist, like, you don't know what the world's going to give back to you. Like, you literally don't know. I am a testament to that. If you told me 10 years ago some of the stuff has happened, I don't know if I would believe you, to be honest. I don't think I would. If you're going to say you're going to present a primetime BBC documentary about your life, like, I don't think I would say that is possible, you know? Have a best-selling book, all this stuff, travel the world, speak to all these massive companies, you know, about dads and masculinity and mental health. I didn't think that was going to happen. So I would say, you know, if you've got an idea, if you're truly passionate about what it is that you're doing, you know, work on your skills, you know, work on your skills, be good at what you do, be very, very good. You know, I try to be world-class at what I do. I pride myself on being very good. So, you know, set those standards for yourself. And literally, I know it sounds cheesy, but you never know what the universe will kind of open up for you.
And do you miss being in the civil service? Do you ever wake up and regret the decision that you made 3.5 years ago?
No. Again, nothing against the civil service. Like, I am very grateful for what it gave me. But I had done what I could do there, you know, to the point where the perm sec of DEFRA was telling me, like, you know, are you sure the civil service can are you sure we can we're enough for you? You know, and I was like, and that was a couple of years before I'd left. You know, she was saying to me, you know, so I think I had done enough of what I could do there. I think I was outgrowing it. I say with, you know, without arrogance and with respect, but, you know, I want to be able to make decisions and make things happen and do things. And working in those big organizations, it's great to learn. And if you are the sort of person that values that structure and security and whatnot, then yes, it can be a very good career for life. But for me personally, I'd done what I could do in the civil service.
And so, Elliot, I'm sure everybody listening to this wants to know what next, as though you haven't done enough already. You've written a fantastic book, Dad. You've got your documentary, which you featured in starred in Becoming Dad. You now speak, you write articles, as you said, you help businesses. So how do you see the future?
Mm. So I kind of when I make plans, I don't necessarily think about like achievements. You know, I think they come, like those things come. Like I would never plan for I plan for inputs. You know, so I try to control what I can do. So there's stuff that I know I can control, and then whatever else happens around that is what happens. You know, so for me. On the music football fatherhood side of things, it's about we've got lots of collaborations with football clubs coming up, collaborations with the Premier League as well. So on that side of things, there we are kind of relaunching our monthly therapist sessions. We were doing those last year. We haven't done one this year yet. We want to do those on a monthly basis. They're called The Lodge. They're monthly kind of online sessions for dads where we get therapists to come and just do group therapy sessions, which are amazing. So that's on the MFF side of things. In regards to like my own stuff, you know, Elliot Ray and the work I do in organizations. So I have a Parenting Out Loud campaign. Parenting Out Loud is empowering working dads to be unapologetically parenting at work, to be open and transparent about their parenting responsibilities. It's a key part of equal parenting. It's a key part of normalizing male caring. It's a key part of gender equality in the workplace and at home. So many dads want to do it, but so many organizations, through maybe poor leadership or culture or policies, aren't in a position to facilitate that. So we have a big campaign. There'll be billboards. Got some recognizable people talking about that campaign in April. So that's going to be amazing. And alongside that, working on our new book, the follow-up to Dad, and also planning a festival as well for the end of the year, which is going to be around kind of masculinity and allyship in the workplace. So really, really excited about that. So those are things that, you know, I know we can do and I can do. Anything else that happens, it happens. But yeah, I'm excited and I, you know, I love my work. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be listened to be able to have ideas and implement them, to see that change happening in the world of work and in families. And I've really enjoyed this interview, actually. It's been a while since someone's kind of talked to me about my life. And it's quite nice to look back and reflect when I was 20 years old and what I was thinking and doing. So, yeah,
Well,
thank you. It's been
it's been a
amazing. I
real
really liked it.
privilege to talk to you, Elliot. And I know everybody listening to this podcast will have been inspired by your journey. It is called the Happy Work Life Podcast, and you've certainly had a happy work life. So thank you for sharing your thoughts and your journey with us all. And we will wish you every success in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
To listen to more episodes and find out how to get happy in your working life, head to workall.co. Work happier.